If you've been paying attention for the past few Sundays, you might remember that I've been speaking out of 1 Peter. And I intend to keep speaking out of 1 Peter, but going to take a bit of a detour this morning. Last week we looked at verse 6, where Peter talks about how that the Christians he was writing to greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials. And J.B. Phillips, in his translation of that, said, they are temporarily harassed by all kinds of trials. Now, what we mean by harassment is far different from what Peter's talking about here in verse 6. To us, an harassment is when we go out to the garage and find the battery on the car's dead. Harassment is when we're talking on the cell phone and we hit a dead spot in the signal. We lose the call. Harassment to us is wearing a mask during the COVID business. That's what we mean by harassment. But when we read 1 Peter, and Peter talks about these grievous trials, the harassments they were enduring, he meant something much more serious. He was talking to people who had to go to work every day for a terrible boss, a boss who would not only be cruel, but could resort to physical violence against them. He was writing to godly women who were married to ungodly men. He was writing to people who were being harmed for doing good. Imagine that. You do the right thing, you do something good, and you're punished for it. He was writing to people who he said were living out a fiery trial, who were partaking of Christ's sufferings. He talked about the fact that judgment must begin at the house of God. He was writing to people who were dealing with an enemy that is compared to a roaring lion. In fact, the situation was so acute to those to whom Peter is writing that in 1 Peter 4, verse 7, he says, the end of all things is at hand. And he wasn't talking about the end of the world. In my judgment, Peter was meaning, what he was saying is that life as we have known it has come to an end. I was watching a movie last night, part of a movie about the Jewish kidnapping of Adolf Eichmann, who was the planner of the Holocaust. He was the German official, Nazi official, who was given the job of figuring out how they were going to get rid of the Jews. And we know that now is the Holocaust. And in this show, there are Jewish agents, the Israeli agents, who were sent to Argentina to kidnap him. It's a true story. How they have flashbacks to when their family in Germany was taken and executed, hung, tortured, destroyed. Life, as those people had known it, had ceased to exist. And I think that's what Peter's talking about when he says that the end of all things is at hand. Those people were in a situation where they got up one morning and found out that their religion had been criminalized. That they were now criminals, enemies of the state, for merely putting their faith in Jesus Christ. I'm not very good at reading the tea leaves, but it may be that's exactly where we're headed in this country. And people say, well, we have a constitutional guarantee about religion. We have freedom of religion. We also have freedom of speech, but there are a lot of people in this country today sitting in jail for exercising their freedom of speech. So don't think that piece of paper is going to protect us or protect anybody if those in charge change their mind about that. Now, Wednesday night, we were in the book of Daniel, Daniel chapter 12, and it dawned on me that the very thing Daniel's talking about in Daniel chapter 12 is what Peter's talking about in 1 Peter 1 and in the rest of the book. And so I had 3 points Wednesday night from Daniel 12 that I thought would make a great 3-point sermon this morning. And I told the folks Wednesday night, please don't get up and leave after communion if what I say Sunday morning starts to sound familiar to you. So there's 6 or 7 here this morning who've heard the basic outline of this lesson before. But I want you to turn back to Daniel chapter 12. And we're going to spend our time there this morning, even though Daniel chapter 12 illustrates what Peter's talking about in 1 Peter. Now, Daniel chapter 10 and 11 and 12 are a prophecy of Jewish history from the time Daniel wrote at the end of his life there in the early part of the Persian Empire. He is given a vision of Jewish history that stretched into the Roman Empire. Nebuchadnezzar had a dream in Daniel chapter 2 of this great statue with four different types of metals, starting with gold, silver, brass, and then iron mixed with clay. And the book of Daniel talks about how those different metals represent different empires. The gold was the Babylonian, the silver the Persian, the bronze the Greek, and then the iron mixed with clay, that was the Roman Empire. And Daniel's given information about what's going to happen to the Jews, the Jewish fate, under each of those empires. And at the end of chapter 11, Daniel gets down to discussing Israel's situation under the Roman Empire. And it's a very dire situation indeed. In fact, in chapter 11, verse 44, here's what's going to happen when Rome comes to rule. Rome is going to go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate. Now, Christ takes what Daniel says in chapter 11. In verse 31, chapter 11, Daniel talks about the abomination of desolation, about pagan symbols, and pagans who not only carry their paganism with them, but destroy anybody who doesn't agree with their paganism. Christ takes that phrase, the abomination of desolation, and in Matthew 24, verse 15, in talking about the judgment that was going to befall the Jewish nation because they rejected the Messiah, Christ says, when you see the abomination of desolation where it shouldn't be in the holy place, you better head for the hills. So Daniel was talking about things that would happen in the first century. Peter is talking about the very same things Daniel had in mind that would happen in the first century. And Peter said, when those things come to happen, the end of all things is at hand. It's like the Holocaust. Life as we have known it is coming to an end. And so the question then becomes, if that's what's happening in the American Empire, history from the human point of view is cyclical. History repeats itself. The Babylonian Empire rose and fell. The Persian Empire rose and fell. The Greek Empire rose and fell. Roman Empire rose and fell. They made the same mistakes. Things kept going round and round. God allowed them to go on so long. Then He pulled the plug on those empires. God will pull the plug on the American Empire. And again, I don't know if that plug pulling is imminent. It may be a long way off. But based on all the signs, life has certainly changed during our lifetimes. And it may be we are near the end. The end of all things is at hand. That life as we have known it is nearing. I don't know that for sure, but it's a possibility. And given that possibility, what do we need to know, and what do we need to remember if we as Christians are going to glorify our Father during these times? Let's read Daniel 12, verses 1 through 4. At that time, at the time when this nation in chapter 11 is going out furiously to destroy and annihilate, at that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. And there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time, and at that time your people shall be delivered. Everyone who is found written in the book, and many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the end of the time. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. I think there are three principles that we need to see from these four verses that deal with the ending of something, the ending of a nation, a change in history. And these three things begin in verse 1. When Daniel says that at the end, it will be a time of distress. You see there in verse 1? There shall be a time of trouble, trouble like you have never seen before. Now that phrase, trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, I think is figurative language. Back in Ezekiel chapter 5, Ezekiel says the same thing. Ezekiel said, and he's talking about the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem. Ezekiel says, when that time comes, there's never been a time like it, there never will be a time like it. And then Christ in Matthew 24, 21 said the same thing, talking about the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans. When that time comes, there's never been a time like it, there never will be a time like it. And I think that language is simply expressing the fact that when history repeats itself and a nation gets to the point where God says, I gave you every chance in the world, you've only gotten more godless, you've only gotten more anti-God, I'm pulling the plug. When a nation gets to that point, the downfall, what happens, is terrible indeed. There is going to be a time of distress. Wednesday night, I remembered a song by John Fogerty, Creedence Clearwater Revival, Bad Moon Rising, and I quoted the lines that he wrote during that song because I think they are applicable to the time of trouble such as we're facing. Fogerty wrote, I hear a hurricane a-blowing. I know the end is coming soon. I fear rivers overflowing. I hear the voice of rage and ruin. Hope you get your things together. Hope you're prepared to die. Looks like we're in for nasty weather when an eye is taken for an eye. Now that's pretty accurate. That describes the kind of trouble that's coming. And folks, we should not be naive about what we're up against. Daniel didn't want his people to be naive about what they would face. Christ didn't want people to be naive about what was coming. In 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8, Peter says, but the devil, as a roaring lion, is walking about seeking whom he may devour. Now, the devil is described under two figures in the New Testament. In 2 Corinthians chapter 11, he is an angel of light. But in 1 Peter chapter 5, he's an animal. He's not an angel, he's an animal. Back in 2 Corinthians, the devil is an angel when he acts like he's one of us. When he acts like he's on our side. When he wants us to think we're on the same team. That's when he's acting like an angel. But when he openly and blatantly turns against us, and he's like a lion walking around seeking whom he may devour, when he gets to the point where he thinks he can destroy us and have no doubt about the fact that that's what his aim is. The devil's aim is to destroy us. He is a liar, he is a murderer, and he is out to destroy the people of God. When he gets like that, Peter says he's like a lion walking about. Now I tell you, I'm not wanting to take on a lion by myself. That's what government can become. Something that we can't face up against. In the book of Revelation, human government is pictured in that book as being a monster. This sea beast, this beast out of the sea, this land beast, these terrible creatures that arise. Now, God intends government to be a minister to His people, to serve people, to protect us, to seek our welfare and commonwealth. But when government turns against us, the minister becomes a monster. Let me read you a headline I copied down the other day. Quote, "Ugly, prejudiced people shield their children from transgenderism." Ugly, prejudiced people shield their children from transgenderism. Now, I'll tell you what, I'm going to do everything I can to shield my family, including my grandchildren, from the perversity that has taken hold of the soul of this nation. Now, according to this headline, that makes me ugly and prejudiced. You know who said that? The President of the United States is who said that. You see how a government that's meant to protect people like us, law-abiding, decent, good citizens, can be turning against us and labeling us with terrible epithets? It's a time of trouble. And we're not to be naive about how dangerous are the dangers that we're facing. But secondly, there in verse 1, it's a time of deliverance. It's a time of difficulty, time of distress. But at that time, your people shall be delivered. We just sang a little bit ago, when all around my soul gives way, when all of the foundations of our society are crumbling and the foundations are being destroyed, He is then my hope and stay. Michael, verse 1 says, shall stand up at this time of trouble. Now, Michael is the only being in the Bible who's called an archangel. The name Michael means who is like God. In other words, there's no one like God. He's called one of the chief princes. Michael is mentioned in the book of Jude as being in a conflict with the devil over the body of Moses. Michael is mentioned in the book of Revelation. Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon and the dragon's followers. There are many who believe that Michael, this warrior protector, is really simply a description of Jesus Christ Himself. But whether that's so or not, the point is, when times of trouble come, when it's a time of distress for the people of God, God says it will be a time of deliverance. God is watching over us. God will move to protect us. And God will do what it takes to watch over and care for His people. Now, that doesn't mean just because God is watching over His people that He's watching over America. Turn to 2 Peter chapter 2. I said in class this morning I was going to refer to this, but 2 Peter chapter 2, starting with verse 6. Peter's talking about how God has stood up and protected His people at various times. In verse 4 and 5, he talks about Noah. To deliver Noah, God destroyed the world. And then in verse 6, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly. And delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked, for that righteous man dwelling among them tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds. then the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations and to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment. God knows how to deliver us. And God says, I will deliver my people. That does not mean America will be saved. You know, for the longest time I've been praying, Lord, take us back to the 1950s. Take us back to the early years of the 1960s. I doubt very much that's what's going to happen. It may be that the way God delivers us is by allowing this nation, this empire, like He has allowed every other empire, to go under, to fall, to be destroyed. And yet, He delivers His people and puts them in a new situation where they can thrive and they can flourish. That may be what's happening. But when there are times of trouble, there are times of deliverance. And who is it that Daniel says God will deliver? It's those whose names are in the book. That's talking about the book of life. In Ezekiel chapter 9, God's getting ready to judge Jerusalem. And He tells the angels, you go through the city and you put a mark on the forehead of every godly person you find. Now imagine those angels tattooing a little cross on your forehead. So that when the destroying angel came to Jerusalem, whenever he saw someone with that little mark on his head, he left them alone. He bypassed them. He passed over them. He protected them. And he destroyed everybody else. When the day of destruction, when the day of judgment comes, who is it who will be spared? Who will be saved? It's those who have that righteous mark on their forehead. Those whose name is in the book. Those who have been washed in the blood. Believing a fact is not the same as having faith in a person. I suspect everybody here today believes the fact of Christ's resurrection. But that doesn't mean you have faith in Christ. Saving faith is more than believing truth. The demons believe truth. James says, they believe and tremble. The demons believe that Jesus was raised from the dead. The demons believe He's the Son of God. They believe there's a hell. They didn't want to go there. They believed in it so much. But they don't put any faith in Jesus Christ. That's the power of sin. That it can keep your heart from the very obvious truth that you ought to obey. If your name's not in the book this morning, you ought to be afraid. Because there's no deliverance promised you. But those who have put their faith and trust in Christ and turned to Him. Daniel says God will raise him up to life, not to shame and to judgment, but will raise him to life. So at the end, whenever that time comes, it's going to be a time of distress because the devil's going to be going about like a roaring lion. It's going to be a time of deliverance because God is going to come to our assistance. But thirdly, it's going to be a time of delusion. And I get this from verse 4. At the very end of verse 4, many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. You know what that means? That means when things start falling apart and it's obvious we're going the wrong way, men increase their activity to try to figure out what's wrong and to fix it. That's what always happens. People in every society that has fallen see things aren't right. Well, what can we do to fix it? So they start running to and fro. They get energetic. They get frantic. They get busy, hoping to find a cure before it's too late. But they don't. The only cure to be found is in God. It's past the point, I think, of us to fix. Turn to John chapter 3. I want to show you something in closing here. John chapter 3. And I want to go here because I think this illustrates the point I'm trying to make about the futility of men, the delusion that men have that they can fix the problem. John 3:16. Have you ever heard this verse before? For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whoever believes in Him should not perish, but have everlasting life. Have you ever heard that verse? That whoever believes in Him shall have everlasting life. Back up to chapter 2 of John, verse 24. In my Bible, they're almost right next to each other on the opposing pages. John 2, verse 24. Now, when Jesus was in Jerusalem there at the time of the Passover, verse 24 says, He did not commit Himself to them because He knew all men. Did you know the word translated commit is the same word translated believes in John 3:16? Jesus did not commit Himself. All these men coming to see Him, around Him, wanting something of Him, showing interest in Him, but Christ did not commit Himself to them. He didn't believe in them. Because He knew what was in them, He knew they were not there to claim Him as Lord. They were there for other reasons. He did not believe in them. I tell you what, I don't believe in men anymore. I don't believe men can solve the problem we're facing. I'm putting my trust in God. Whatever God wants to do is fine with me. I told the class this morning that I've become like Elijah. Paul reminded the Jews that there was a day when Elijah prayed to God against Israel. Elijah wanted God to punish Israel, to lower the boom. I never thought I'd pray that about America. I never thought I'd pray to God against Israel. God bless America. That's what we sing. But it's gotten so bad. It's gotten so disgusting and twisted and rotten that I understand Elijah now. I understand how he could pray to God against his own nation. And my prayer, folks, frankly, is, Lord, do whatever it takes to clean up the mess that we've got. But the point of all of this morning is, if you draw your own conclusions, I'm not asking you to adopt my view of anything or to accept my conclusions, but if you draw your own conclusions that we are hurtling toward the end, what do the people of God need to remember? Well, it's going to be a time of distress. It's going to get bad. But it's going to be a time of deliverance when God remembers us and is looking over us and caring for us in His providential will. And it's going to be a time of delusion when men continue to think the problem they made, they can fix. Three principles to guide us in times that trouble men's souls.